Hello, 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 and welcome to the Velvet Studio, home of Canada's queer media radio show, GLBT Community Talk Show. I really have to come up with a new tagline because I change it every single day, and I don't think I've stuck with the same thing for more than 1 week in a row.
Change is good.
Absolutely, absolutely. And today we are going to be talking about essentially a string of HIV-related news that's kind of been coming up and happening. And I am joined by the Executive Director of the Canadian AIDS Society. How are you doing today?
Fantastic. And yourself, Luke?
I'm not too bad. And so we are going to be talking about... I think the impetus for this conversation was a lot of news happening around changes to the funding that was made available from the PHAC, mm-hmm. which I'm trying to remember is Public
Health Agency of Canada.
There we go. I was like, what is the A? And I was like, I assume the C was Canada.
Because some people have different acronyms, you know.
This is true. I can imagine that after news about this funding clawback, I'm sure the acronym took on a much more sour tone with certain agencies. Now, what I thought was interesting was, you know, first of all, the extent that funding was that was made available before, and the amount of funding that's been requested and the amount of funding that was then taken away. Yeah. Sorry about that. Mm-hmm. I think that out of all of the agencies looking for funding, I think about 68 million had been requested, but only about 20 million had been made available. Yeah,
26.4 million was made available. Mm-hmm. But the main issue was that there's a dilution of funds to HIV-specific work.
Okay.
Because they combined Hep C, all STBBIs under the same scope of work under the Community Action Fund, which was $26.4 million envelope. Plus, there was a directed request for funding that was directed at one agency alone that took right off the top $4 million away from that.
Oh my God! What was the agency that got the $4 million?
Well, I'd rather not say. We're still on speaking terms, and I like to stay there. But it was they do tremendous work. That's not the issue. It's just that we were not advised that this was being done. So that was a bit of a right. We were right sided on that, blind sided. I mean on that. But the funds have been diluted out of HIV quite a bit, but it stayed at the same amount as $26.4 million. So we did see 33% of the HIV organizations that were funded under the old cycle not being funded moving forward.
Is that because of the other STBBI agencies were taking money from the same pot, essentially, is
yes.
what I'm getting?
But we have to look at it as being, because there are new players in the topography of what's happening with the HIV movement in Canada, and that's good news. Mm-hmm. But it shouldn't be at the detriment of the HIV organizations that have been on the field for 30 years.
Yeah.
And what we said to the to PHAC and to the Minister of Health was that the whole process was riddled with landmines as we move forward because they didn't consult with the community to see mm-hmm. what the funding for the Community Action Fund would look like. So when we went into our funding cycles and the criteria kept changing all the way until the end. So okay. a lot of organizations did not ramp up to meet that criteria.
So kind of they not only moved the yardstick, but they also changed the rules of the game by the sounds of it at the same time.
Exactly. And that was the crux of our offensive concerning the funding, and we won because our combined efforts with all the agencies across Canada, with our letter writing campaigns to Justin Trudeau, to Jane Philpott, who's the Minister of Health, and to we even wrote to all the premiers and local health ministers across all the provinces and territories. Mm-hmm. And we told them that because what they were told at the beginning was that we're not funding these 33% of the organizations because they're doing provincial territorial work.
Oh, but the provinces had not stepped up
no.
to fill the gap. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was really disingenuous of them to do that without having the safety net put in place to accommodate yeah. this funding. Yeah. And we know that each province is fighting for health dollars as it is. Mm-hmm. So that was quite disingenuous of them. And so finally we did get a milestone, which is that all organizations that were defunded will get a year of transitional funding until March 2018. Mm-hmm. And that's where we're not sure yet, and I'll wait for that. But is that that funding, we want it to be at the same level that they received last year.
Yeah.
To address the gaps and also to wind down the services that they do have now under the PIAC funding that they have. So that's where we're making sure that that's coming to fruition. And because we were one of the agencies that were cut.
Absolutely, yeah.
So so that's what we're keeping an eye on. But our advocacy and our lobbying work will change as of January once we're sure we're ensured that the process worked for the transitional funding to have the fund increased. Because it hasn't been increased for years, and it has to be if we're going to really attain the objectives that the UNAIDS have out there.
So you said in an earlier conversation that UNAIDS have kind of set the goal of, I think you said
99.98. Yeah, for 2030.
Absolutely. And 2030 just seems so far away. You know, is it achievable? But, you know, the sense I got from our conversation earlier is that maybe not, but, you know, if we all came together and really substantially put a lot of work in, maybe it is possible.
Yeah, because, you know, what we saw with this funding model that the government came out with, they addressed it as being the do-all to end-all for the 90-90-90 objectives. And just to specify what those are is that 90% of people know their status, and we're talking the whole world. So okay, that's Africa, that's Canada, that's U.S., everybody combined. 90% are in treatment and 90% are undetectable. Mm-hmm. I know their status, I mean. So that's those were the 390-90-90s. But the funding model that they used was really to prevent HIV being transmitted. So that only addresses 190. Yeah. You're not taking a holistic approach to the three objectives, just doing one of them. So when we looked at who was defunded, there were a lot of organizations that did second-line prevention for people who have HIV already to make sure and ensure that they don't retransmit and that they don't receive other infections that are out there.
I think people forget that there's multiple strains of HIV.
Yes, there are. And that's becoming an issue in treating HIV. Mm-hmm. Because the different strains are coming into the country, and there's not enough evidence out there to really exactly know which ones, but there's a mutation happening, that's for sure.
And I think that presents so many issues, that why the second line of support is so incredibly important. I think it's interesting. I know that in the UK they've identified that about 11% of the population doesn't know their status. Now, is it a similar number? I mean, they're pretty close to their 90 in the UK. What's the number looking like here in Canada?
We have 21% of people who are living with HIV who do not know their status
in Canada. That's almost double the UK average.
Yeah. And it's for different reasons. I mean, we have criminalization laws against people who have HIV who do not disclose. So a lot of people are saying, I'd rather not know my status so I don't have to disclose.
Yeah.
There's a whole mix of different issues that are underlying there. And it really comes back to having behavioral research done to understand the behavior of people who are living with HIV, because it's not the same data we'd capture that's happening in the UK or in the States or in Africa. We are culturally different in Canada, and that has to be captured in that. And there's never been enough funding for behavioral done in Canada.
I think we also, there's a lot to be said about the differences between Canada and the UK in terms of how this is approached as well. You know, a lot of people, for example, to use another UK example to kind of compare and contrast, over half of all new infections in the whole of the UK was in London. Just that one city. It counts in over half of all, I think it was closer to 60% of all new infections was just in London. You know, and I don't think that's the case here in Canada. I think it's spread out across multiple provinces, the more populous provinces, certainly. But we also have rural areas. You know, what's the story like in places like Nova Scotia or New Brunswick? How does that compare to Toronto?
Well, we have pockets because the rural setting is completely different from the city centers, and we know that. Mm-hmm. And the issues that we have perceived in the Maritimes is that there's a lot of people not getting tested first of all. Second of all, they're not accessing treatment because the rule setting is that you go to the pharmacy, it's your cousin who's behind the counter. Do you want them to know that you have HIV? No. So that's a barrier that we have now. And stigma is a huge issue in HIV. And but we do have pockets, like in Saskatchewan with the Aboriginal population, the rates are off the map. Mm-hmm. So we really have to have a multi-pronged approach on how we do prevention. If we don't address that, we're not going to win the war.
Absolutely. And I think it worries me, you mentioned earlier about the criminalization element.
Mm-hmm.
I like to think, you know, perhaps we're past that. But then things happen that just makes me think, you know, maybe we haven't got as far as we think as Canadians that we have got. You know, a couple of months ago, the Toronto Police Service officially apologized for the bathhouse raids in the 80s and the 90s, Project Soap, I think, they apologized for. And then they very promptly raided Etobicoke Park and rounded up a number of men having sex with men. I think 96% of all of the men, all of the people caught were men.
Yeah, and how many of those were married?
And I think that you've hit the nail on the head there. I think it's a different environment. I was always under the impression that that people hooking up were maybe not gay men, because usually gay men are out or they have places they can go, and they may have been, you know, more, you know, people who identify or have to identify as straight using those limited options, which include public cruising. You know, is that something that perhaps I've got wrong, or
I've looked at the case in Etobicoke a bit, but the underlying issue is stigma. That's the underlying issue, and it's also the cruising has existed in the our LGBT community for eons, and it's not going to change tomorrow. And parks, though done this extremely discreetly, has always been a privileged place for cruising. So you have to have also, again, different ways to do to work with that. And also community organizations do outreach in known cruising areas for HIV and other STBBIs.
Absolutely. And I think it's knowing that it goes on. I mean, cracking the whip like they did in Etobicoke, all that does is drive it underground. You know, maybe to the subway system or to more generally, you know, in places that are less known, which means that there's less of a response, which means that service agencies are less able to know where to go to help people. I know in Ottawa, the solution was more of a public awareness campaign, and some different agencies got together and kind of did some outreach.
Yeah, but we have agencies across Canada that go into private sex parties to do prevention. You know, that's amazing.
I did not even know that was...
Yeah, there's ACCM in Montreal that have a funding for contact, which they go into private parties, and they have outreach workers that go and talk about safe sex practices, and they're in the they're not in the practice, but they're there to help out people and to talk to them about safe sex practices when it arises.
Like so during the event.
Yeah, exactly. During the event, yeah. So it's that's the outreach that community organizations across Canada do.
Absolutely. And I think that probably you see a bit of an increase. Now, you mentioned earlier that the unknown rate is at 21, but I think that's gone down, hasn't it?
It's gone down from the last couple of years from 26 to 21. So that's a success in itself.
Absolutely. We can't underestimate the amount of great work that has been achieved.
Yeah.
That has been achieved from awareness. But I think we have a long way to go. And I think what we'll do is we'll talk about how events like World AIDS Day can help build up awareness, and maybe the shocking news stories where people are completely unaware. For example, the Irish politician who didn't know that straight people could catch HIV.
Oh, God.
Or was it Scottish politician? I forget which one. But similar stories to that come up all the time, most unfortunately. But we're going to play the Pet Shop Boys' Dreaming of the Queen. And I, you know, most people think this is just a patriotic song about the Queen. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I like it, because on that level it is. But apparently the song was also written about the AIDS crisis at the time. I think it was written to commemorate somebody that they knew. So we'll be back just after this. You and her and I. Hello and welcome back. Now, we were just talking about what are some of the other things that may have been cut by this funding, because we were talking. I mean, I was first of all amazed that people would show up to these parties, and I'm like, you know, and the question they asked you is, you know, is it worth the money to send a staff member to a party of like 5 to 10 people, you know? Like, I've never been to one of these parties. Clearly, nobody's invited me.
I haven't received the invitation either, so maybe we should talk after the show.
Absolutely. If you want to join in, contact us. No, not really. But, No, the idea being that, you know, is it worth the dollar per head of investment for that service? And actually, you astounded me when you said that, you know, if that group of 5 or 10 people prevents one transmission, mm-hmm. like one person's lifetime cost in medication is $1.3 million.
The cost to society.
Oh, I see. So just more
the overall cost.
So loss of income, loss of tax income, of absolute. Wow, that's incredible.
Social services, health services. So it's $1.3 million. So just by blocking one transmission, mm-hmm. I mean $1.3 million. That's finances four or five organizations in one province.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely,
that's huge.
So it's certainly worth the money.
It is.
We also talked briefly about what are the services that kind of are also being cut. And it made me think, I actually had a chance to tour the AIDS Committee of Ottawa. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised. I mean, I don't know why I was surprised, but I had never thought about the fact that they have a food bank there. Yeah. They have laundry machines that they do support mm-hmm. with. They have different group environments. And when you sit and you think, you know, these folks are people who are being incredibly stigmatized, you know, they mm-hmm. You know, it becomes a very difficult environment. They often are then without a job as a result,
homeless,
having absolutely homeless, having the supports of a laundry machine and, you know, a food bank and that kind of support absolutely makes a huge difference.
It does, because I look where I used to be executive director in Montreal, and we did about the same things that ACO does. And you look at Bruce House, who was defunded mm-hmm. completely, and the work that they do for hospice care or whatever they're doing there, it's tremendous work. And it captures, because I was talking about the different generations of people living with HIV in the last 30 years, because I look at it more as being generational, because the first wave of people who had HIV had to go on social assistance to get their medication. Mm-hmm. So they had to quit their jobs and everything else, but a lot of people were extremely sick too at the time.
Yeah.
Now, there's a different economy happening, is that people are working full-time, they get transmitted HIV, but they stay in the work environment. So that's a huge success. But the most vulnerable I find today are people who are under workforce who have no group insurance.
Yeah.
So those people don't have access to psychologists or whatever, and that's where community organizations really thrive. Mm. And we talk about immigration, we talk about Aboriginal needs, and all the other subsets of needs that are out there are being addressed by community organizations. And we have to recognize, and the government also has to recognize, that the community organizations are a direct extension of the health and social services in Canada. It has to be recognized at the same level mm-hmm. because we always classify ourselves to a certain extent the dirty workers, because we're paid maybe all the way down to 1/5 of what a professional worker, and these people are professionals also. Mm-hmm. So we're the cheap extension of the health system, but we do tremendous work. And if we weren't there, the cost for health care in Canada would go up tremendously.
I think if we look at Bruce House as a good example, I mean, the hospice care that they do, mm-hmm. if they weren't there, these folks would end up on the public system.
Yep.
You know, they would end up maybe in hospitals with all of the costs related to you know, that kind of care. And yeah, absolutely. I think we're saving lots of money by having
tremendous dollars.
Folks. Absolutely. Yeah,
because, you know, like the direct care that these organizations are giving is car accompaniment, bringing people to the medical appointments, mm-hmm. making sure that they stay on their meds and they're undetectable and don't transmit HIV. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the fundamental of the work we're doing across Canada. There's home care programs to ensure that people stay in their home environment where they're well, but they need sporadic or continuous care at home. Mm-hmm. So those people aren't going into the care system that's officially being paid by Health Canada. They're being taken care of by the social infrastructure we have out there, which is called community organizations.
I wonder if there's any calculations been done that looks at what kind of net savings that has been.
That's one of the studies I'd like to do.
Absolutely. Like, and what is the dollar value of extended care if you were to, you know, completely privatize it, put it entirely on the public purse, and then in the middle of the community agencies? And I would be interested in seeing what that is.
I would too, and I think you've just challenged me to do it, and I think I will, because we need those numbers.
We'll make a GoFundMe campaign.
Yeah, GoFundMe campaign. I think we all need a GoFundMe in the HIV sector now.
I can imagine that. Yeah. It's interesting that you mention that. My mother used to work as a volunteer coordinator with the Canadian AIDS Society, and a big part of some of the work she did was literally driving people to their appointments for therapy and medication, and it really can make and break people if you miss treatments, and I think that's something that people forget. If you're ill, are you able to get behind the car and drive? You know, are you? You know,
do you have a car?
Do you have a car? If you don't have a job, do you have a car? You know, yeah. It's difficult to make insurance payments when you don't have that kind of income to support it. Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's really that incremental work that everybody does that's really, for us, keeps the autonomy of the people in their own homes. Mm-hmm. And we see it in every city I've been to across Canada to look at the services that our agencies are doing, our member agencies, and it's amazing. And the impact is there because, you know, they don't only go to medical appointments, they go to food banks. Mm-hmm. We have agencies that help people to get into social housing that are on the street. So it's all the reinsertion to being a productive citizen also that's there to get people off the street, to get them into social housing or permanent housing, and all that work that's there, and to maintain them in their home environment. That's a huge success that's not really talked about.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the generational differences earlier, and I was wondering, you know, where do the youth come into this? Now, I know that a lot of folks in my generation and the generations below me, and I was joking earlier, you know, we see it like diabetes, and then you mentioned that you have diabetes, and not as much fun as people crack it up to be. But I think with my generation that we're seeing, we don't have the trauma of the amount of deaths that came with the AIDS crisis. Now, a lot of folks were deeply impacted by the wiping out of an entire generation of gay men. Like, mm-hmm. it decimated our culture and our history, and its impacts are going to be felt for many more years to come. So we don't have that. We don't have the really big stick. Now we're seeing with the popularization of, like, pre-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP, or the post-exposure, which...
PEP.
I forget what that one's nickname was. You know, it's almost being viewed like going on the pill not to get pregnant. Like, it's not seen as much of an issue. And that, you know, a part of me is a bit worried. Are we underestimating as youth how much of an impact contracting HIV would be?
I think so. And I think that's driven by marketing a lot from the pharmaceutical industry, because we're always saying we have this beautiful picture of a guy or a girl who has HIV, and it's one pill a day. Mm-hmm. So a lot of youth think, well, it's not that bad. So, but when they do contract HIV, the story changes dramatically. They do view it as a death sentence, and it's not. But we need to be able to give those people the support they need to understand what living with HIV will be. Mm-hmm. And we have to also underscore that knowledge has come from the people before them.
Yeah.
So the older generation, the ones that have had HIV for 30 years, and the ones that they have a dialogue and they have the history, that I think there's a mentoring that has to be done between aging people with HIV and youth. And it's not easily done, but I think it's disingenuous not to allow that to happen. Mm-hmm. But when we're talking about PrEP and PEP, because PrEP is pre-exposure, so people will take, it's a tool that we have, and we're talking about having a toolkit for prevention, and PrEP and PEP are part of that. The same thing as TASP. And all these acronyms are really bugging a lot of people because we don't know what they mean. But PrEP is really pre-exposure prophylaxis. So that means that somebody, let's say you fall in love with a guy, he has HIV. You want to maintain your status of HIV negative, and you know that condoms may break. You may want to have condomless sex or whatever, and PrEP is a good tool for you. And that's what PrEP is used for. You'll take the same medication as someone who's on HIV. Those studies are looking at reducing the amount of drugs you take for PrEP, and you will be, you'll have a barrier to contracting HIV from anyone. So that's a tool amongst others, which the others are condom and harm reduction methods that are out there. PEP is really for post-exposure. So if you've had a condom breakage, or you've had a risk that somebody told you after the act that they have HIV, you could go to a clinic and you will be prescribed PEP, which is pre-exposure, post-exposure, I mean, and you'll not contract HIV even after the fact. And TASP, which is really treatment as prevention, which we endorsed on the 1st of December this year because the science is there, is that anyone who is on, who has HIV, who is religiously taking their medication, and they cannot transmit HIV if they're undetectable.
Yeah.
So somebody who's been on their treatment for 6 months, that's why we suggest that people go on their treatment as soon as possible now also.
Yeah.
They cannot transmit HIV, so that's one of the objectives of 90-90-90 also.
So the 90% being undetectable.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And on treatment, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's really interesting because I think, if I remember, and you may correct me because I my memory isn't what it should be, but I believe that there is a theoretical risk.
Yeah.
At that point. Well, when somebody, you know, theoretical risk, you know, people see that on the back of like prescription tablets and like, oh, that might happen. But I think it's like one in like 6 million or some crazy statistical anomaly where it could happen.
Yeah.
But they have to put it in.
Yes, they do. And, you know, I've been in the movement for 9 years now, involved in the HIV organizations. And when the first study came out about treatment as prevention, I was kind of weary because we, as we were talking before, the cure is announced every 2 months and we don't see it yet. So the when we saw that, we took it with a grain of salt because we said we need more researches that will point us into that direction. And now we feel that we're at a point where we can say treatment as prevention is a tool in the toolkit, and we endorse it completely. Even if there's a theoretical risk, the thing is that we have to also underline and underscore our the advances that we have, and treatment as prevention is one of them, and PrEP is one of them, PEP is one of them, and a condom is one of them. But we have to adapt to the different strategies that adapt to ourselves and what we're doing as risk factors.
What we actually came across an op-ed or an opinion piece in Out magazine, and what I thought was interesting about this article, and I disagreed with, and I'll get into why I disagree with it later, but the article was looking at people who essentially body shame folks who choose not to use a condom but choose to use PrEP as a form of you know, they use that tool to kind of avoid getting HIV. I can see why there's a lot of stigma. There's so much stigma around HIV that there's even, you know, the idea of opting for the pill instead of for a condom certainly has its own its own stigmas. And I can understand where that narrative is coming from. Do you see that folks are averse to people on PrEP or?
Well, I've been following the PrEP discussion groups on Facebook and so on and so forth, and at the beginning, you know, like you have two different discourses, the ones that work in the field, the ones that are engaged in the field, and you talk to the general population, and there's a separation of ideas there that's pretty remarkable. But for me, whatever works to get to attain the zero transmissions, I will endorse up to a certain extent. But the shaming of people who are in PrEP, I find is completely disrespectful of our own risks that we've taken in the past.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, we've all been in a situation, and I'm talking as much gay as straight, where we've been in a situation where we've the risk has been evident and we didn't do anything about it because the behavioral science behind it, we haven't really looked at it completely yet. Mm-hmm. Though Joanna Tsis from the University of Quebec in Montreal has roadmapped the behavior and the reduction, the increase of risk behavior pertaining to different risk factors that people will not use a condom because it's their Prince Charming or whatever reason is there. But I think we have to also celebrate our sexuality. And so we have to find the middle ground. And I think the middle ground is different for every person, and we have to adapt to that because it's a changing landscape. Mm-hmm. But I think whatever works, we have to at least look at it with an open mind and draw the conclusion that if it blocks the transmission, hell, why wouldn't we endorse it?
I think that's absolutely right. And I think that with the 1.3 price tag, that's certainly something we should be massively focusing on. My only aversion to that in the way it has been promoted is that it doesn't account for like super gonorrhea, which has emerged in a lot of places, you know, a gonorrhea that's resistant to so many drugs, you know, or syphilis or crabs. You know, if you have crabs and you're on PrEP, it's gonna do nothing for crabs.
Even if you use a condom, crabs will get through there, no problem. True, so, you know, true. That wasn't a good example.
That was a terrible example, but my point stands that there are other sexually transmitted infections and diseases, maybe not diseases, because I think PrEP does tackle some of them a little bit, but I think people need to be aware that if they are choosing that tool in the toolkit, that they should also be cognizant of other risks for the other infections.
Yeah, and that's where your doctor or your community organization comes into the fold and tells you exactly what the risk factors are of every prevention tool that's out there.
Yeah,
and it's true that PrEP only blocks HIV, so it's like the pill. For women, if it only blocks pregnancies, it doesn't block STDs or STBBIs. And that's a discussion that you have to have, because getting a gonorrhea today and the super gonorrhea is only in the gay population, which is another indication. But what I do and what other people would do may be completely different, and I have to respect that to a certain extent because what we do in our bedroom. But it becomes really hard to have a position on it when you represent the whole.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I can have positions on anything I like because that's one of the benefits of doing a radio show. Anyways, right after this, we'll talk about why World AIDS Day is important. I think we were going to talk about it earlier, but I kind of sideswiped that conversation. We're going to play the last song by Elton John. I'm on a British roll today, apparently. Also a song that came out of the HIV crisis.
Great song.
And we'll be back just after this.
Yesterday, you came to lift me up, as light as straw and brittle as a bird. Today, I weigh less than a shadow on the wall, just one more whisper of a voice unheard. Tomorrow, leave the windows open, as fear grows, please hold me in your arms. Won't you help me if you can to shake this anger? I need your gentle hands to keep me calm, 'cause I never thought I'd lose. I only thought I'd win. I never dreamed I'd feel this fire beneath my skin. I can't believe you love me. I never thought you'd come. I guess I misjudged love. between a father and his son. Things we never said come together. The hidden truth no longer haunting me. Tonight we touched on things that were never spoken. That kind of understanding sets me free. 'Cause I never thought I'd lose. I only thought I'd win. I never dreamed I'd feel this fire beneath my skin. I can't believe you love me. I never thought you'd come. I guess I misjudged love between a father and his son.
Hello and welcome back. We're here talking about HIV today with the executive director of the Canadian AIDS Society. And we were kind of actually during the show, we were talking about how it's a difficult tightrope between really encouraging people to be sensible,
mm-hmm.
And you mentioned taking ownership, really yep. taking ownership of your own sexual health,
mm-hmm.
and also the sexual health, you know, taking some kind of responsibility for the sexual health of people that you were having sex with, even if it's you or if you're in one of these parties that I'm not invited to. You know, mm-hmm. either way, yeah. there's a degree.
Well, you're just jealous. That's the whole thing.
I know. Clearly, but this is just I'm bitter and upset that nobody invited me to one of these parties.
But, you know, like I do have professional personal opinions, but I really think that it's not only one's sexual health that they have to watch out for.
Mm-hmm.
It's because the responsibility is you're co-responsible with the partner you're having sex with.
Mm-hmm.
It cannot be put solely on the shoulders of one.
Absolutely.
So we have to watch out for that discourse, because that discourse brought the new criminalization laws that we have for the last few years. So that's where I'm hesitant to endorse that kind of statement. But it is principally your self-worth that you have to look at mm-hmm. and say, well, do I want to live through a resistant gonorrhea that's going to keep me on meds or I may not get a cure for anymore? Or do I get Hep C as a ricochet from HIV or whatever other disease, chlamydia or whatever that's out there? That's where I think we have to take a pause in our own lives and reevaluate, okay, what are the risks that I'm ready to take depending on the situation that I'm living in?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the pause that we should be teaching our children. But there's also a whole generation that didn't have sex ed either.
Yep.
So that's what we're living with the results of now, with certain provinces going back towards sex ed. I hope it will re-engage that discussion. Because it's funny to see that we thought, and my generation, because I'm over 50, we thought our parents were really prudes and we were going to be revolutionizing everything in the 70s and the 60s for free sex and great sex and whatever. But we were even more, we cut off our children even more than our parents cut us off from sex. So we have to get back to an open discussion with our children and with our peers about exactly what we think our self-worth is towards our sexual health.
And I think I just want to touch on, you know, it's not the position of myself and the Women's Studio that folks living with HIV are the ones entirely responsible. No. I think it takes two to tango, and there's definitely some culpability on both sides there. But my point really is that people, especially of my generation, need to take stock when they are about to engage in these things. And I know I've been in that environment. You know, you've got hormones racing, and it's like, you just want to be in the party, as it were.
Yeah.
And, you know, taking stock at that point is a difficult thing to do. So maybe beforehand, evaluate what you're going to do. But what I was going to raise earlier is that navigating between, you know, doom, gloom, fire and brimstone, watch out for your own health, compared with not demonizing folks who have HIV. Like, that's a very thin tightrope to walk. And I hope if anyone believes that perhaps he swung too much one way or the other, tweet us at Velvet Studio One. But I want to bring it up because media representation of HIV in Canada has been deplorable. There was a major study that came out, and they found that 68% of all of the articles related to HIV in Canada looked at the criminalization of racialized people, even though they only accounted for 20% of HIV criminalization cases. So whenever we talk as media about people being criminalized with HIV, we're zeroing in on people who are racialized or Aboriginal. And I think, you know, that's a huge issue. I can see that's an issue. I think most people realize that's an issue. Why are we drawn, do you think, to looking specifically at, you know, just people with racialized bodies, just Aboriginal folks, and not looking at the majority of cases, the vast majority of cases, which is white people transmitting HIV and not disclosing?
Oh, Pandora's box.
we're out of time. No, I'm just kidding.
that's where I think there has to be a discussion. That's really there's a discussion missing. That's, I think everything that's sexual is sort of taboo, but it's not taboo at the same time. I think we're very flippant towards our own sexual health. And talking about it, just getting a HIV test out of your medical practitioner is like pulling teeth. So there's that whole thing. Like the biggest stigma I've seen in HIV has been with HIV positive people coming to our agency in Montreal telling us, well, my practitioner doesn't believe I should be having sex because I have HIV. I think, so, you know, there's a lot of stuff around there that I think that has to be pushed aside, and we have to get back down to the basics and really discuss what our sexual health looks like.
Yeah.
And to open that discussion and to, in a preventive way, but also in a holistic way, that we do respect the differences that everybody comes to the table with. I think I may have avoided your question to a certain extent.
That's fine. I suppose I'll answer my own question, which I think is that we're turning a bit of a blind eye. We're turning a blind eye to these things. I think the coverage has been, unfortunately, racist as a result of that, and we need to address that. So I think the media industry has a bit of soul-searching to do on this front. But I think what we should be doing, and what the media ought to be doing, is really promoting a more sensible, safe sex kind of approach for everybody.
Yes, but they don't, because I look at the media requests I had last week for World AIDS Day, let's say, okay?
Good segue.
It's a good segue. Yeah, we'll change subjects, but anyways, no, but they were all about PrEP. Why? But we never discuss the side effects of treatment. We never discuss why people should be on treatment. We never discuss the basics of sexual health. All they want is what are we going to talk about this year? And I said, well, that's last year's theme was PrEP. This year is not
PrEP. It was the cause du jour of 2016.
But still, it's like we're on a different page. We're in a different setting now.
Yeah.
And we should be talking about prevention and secondary prevention for people who have HIV and not only people who are negative. Mm-hmm. And that discourse is not happening with the media.
I think it centers a lot around, it is centered for folks who are HIV negative. It's like, you know, I want to avoid the big bad beast of HIV. How do I do that? And that's a story that's easy to sell. You know, that's a story that's easy to push. You know, this is how you can avoid all the woes. Go on PrEP. And I can see how that would be from the media.
But I think we're our own worst enemy.
Yes.
Because we talk about PrEP. We talk about seropositive. We talk about HIV and all this, but nobody knows what they mean.
So for folks listening, seropositive is someone who has HIV.
Yes.
And seronegative is someone who doesn't. And serodiscordant relationships is where one does
and
the other one doesn't.
So
we like to occasionally define terms so everyone's on the same page.
So that's why I think it's disingenuous a bit from media, is that we don't really address the real words. And, and also in our own movement is that we talk in slang or we talk in acronyms where it doesn't really reach out to Mr. and Mrs. Everybody out there. That's a bit to our detriment.
I know that one of my favorite things, or one of Sebastian's favorite things when we talk about HIV and the medication, mm-hmm. is to talk about diarrhea, because people never mention the side effects, as you mentioned, and nobody talks about the diarrhea. Probably for good reason, because who wants to talk about diarrhea?
Oprah.
But I would believe Oprah talks about diarrhea.
Yeah.
What was the significance of having Prime Minister Trudeau with his red scarf and MP Randy Boissonneau, who's now the LGBTQ2A advisor, mm-hmm. on the Hill talking about HIV and World AIDS Day? Why was that important?
That was extremely important because it brings it down to a population level, more broader than just people are living with HIV, because it seems that we're talking only to people who have HIV, and that's not the discussion we have to have.
Literally, so, preaching to the converted.
Yes, that's exactly. But having the Prime Minister there, though the flag should have been bilingual, my little take on it, because we do live in a bilingual country.
Sure.
But I think every effort is being done. Like, we look at Rihanna and the Prince having a HIV test in Barbados.
Absolutely.
In Barbados, I mean, it's huge. So having the Prime Minister and the Minister having a test after, and so on and so forth, I think all of those open the discussion. Mm-hmm. And we've never had really a spokesperson in Canada who would talk about HIV. And that's lacking in the media landscape. So I think all these efforts are fantastic. And with that, that's really getting it in the front page news and talking about it and getting discussions going. And if you're a parent out there, well, gee whiz, take that front page of the flag raising on Parliament Hill on December 1st and open a discussion with your kids.
Absolutely.
Open a discussion between you with your partner or your boyfriend or anybody you have in your life. Why not?
Mm-hmm. I mean, if just to go back to it, if you're a parent with kids, maybe openly talk about, should we go test it and make mm-hmm. it sound like you're going grocery shopping? You know, normalize preventative healthcare as a behavior.
As our testing campaign said last year, it's just a little prick.
From the needle, that is. Well, yes. I get panic attacks from small pricks with needles. No, from needles. There we go. That's the one. But I forget where I was going. I completely lost my thought there now. Got distracted by a
little prick.
From a needle.
Yes.
Absolutely. But absolutely. I think now folks need to come and kind of get tested. The 21% of folks not knowing, that's too high.
Yeah.
And for anyone interested, not knowing is not actually a legal defense. So that's not...
No, that's still being debated at the moment. But I think that it's taking care of your body and your soul mm-hmm. and yourself is getting tested regularly.
Yeah.
Even if you think you're not at risk, is to make sure, because there are dormant cases out there. But it's also a good chance for you to reach out to your doctor and educate them.
Absolutely.
Because it's like pulling teeth to get tested to get a HIV or any other STBBI test out there with our doctors. So reach out to your doctor or healthcare professional or in any clinic and ask for a test. It doesn't take much time and you'll have a clear mind.
Now, we mentioned earlier that you actually have a lot of members in the Canadian AIDS Society of Ottawa, Canadian AIDS Society, end mm-hmm. of name. And for folks listening across the country, you know, find out what the local service agency is. What is the community service provider where you are? Because some of the services they provide is rapid testing or anonymous testing. Mm-hmm. And we mentioned earlier in the conversation that we don't think we'll have time to get to about home testing. But the difference is you don't have anyone to talk to if that happens.
Exactly.
There's no support if, you know, heaven forbid, you don't get the news you're looking for. In that case, you know, try and find out what's available near you. Reach out to these agencies and they should be able to help you out. Thank you so much
You're welcome.
Has been a thoroughly enlightening conversation.
And, well, I thank you. And volunteer at them, at those agencies.
Give
also
a little bit of time, you know.
A little bit of time and love.
Absolutely. We mentioned the hospice care and how important that is and all those things. We're actually playing out with not another Brit, mainly because I'm not allowed. I've been told off. But we're playing out with Sarah McLachlan's Hold On, another song that also came as a result out of the HIV movement and so on. So we'll be back next week. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
for this is gonna hurt like hell.